Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am always pleased when I can welcome back into our studios Lisa Konetsky, who is a professor of theater arts at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Professor Konetsky and I go back a long way. I fondly remember our conversations from a number of years ago back in our old studios when we were part of when she would come onto the morning show during her first stint on the theater department at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And then for a while, Lisa was gone doing some other exciting things and now has been back for actually how many years at Parkside?
I think it's eight.
8 years back.
I think it's eight, yeah.
Very good. So anyway, it's great to have her on the morning show today.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure your mic's on. Why don't you just pull number two over there just in case. I'm not sure what's amiss here.
Better?
Yeah, that's okay. A little better. Still not quite right, but we're hearing you at least. And I'm hoping Dave McGrath will sneak in here in just a moment and get things rectified exactly right. We'll figure it out.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, about 8 years now you've been back. So what is the sort of total arc of your time at Parkside?
Oh, wow. Well, I started at Parkside in 1985. I was there for 13 years, left for 10, went to UW System and worked in system administration for 10 years, and then came back after having a really great time doing faculty development and focusing on teaching and learning at the system level. But I missed my discipline. I missed students. I missed teaching. I missed directing. So I was lucky enough to be able to come back to Parkside. So I think it's 8 years. I think it's early this morning for me,
right.
And I'm really glad I came back. It's been a wonderful opportunity to sort of have a career that's been kind of cyclical. I've kind of come back to where I started and back to some of the original reasons that I started teaching. So administration is a little out of the picture now. I'm no longer chair, and I'm really enjoying that.
Right. And, of course, another thing that, of course, has made this second stint at Parkside especially exciting is that it was at some point, probably halfway through or so, that this beautiful renovation and expansion occurred with the Rita, and
yes,
that's made life a whole lot better, I should think, for you in the theater department.
Yes, I mean, it really gives us and certainly the students so many more opportunities for production values, for rehearsal space. It's a beautiful facility. I don't know many theater departments that have anything close to what we have, so it's a real pleasure to work there.
Well, today we are going to be talking about one of the great masterworks in the history of theater and one of the central works of the great William Shakespeare, his play Macbeth, which opens this weekend and runs for the next two weekends. And, of course, one of the most interesting things is we're calling down thunderbolts from the sky because we're saying Macbeth. That's not an important thing, and yet let's just say a word about this interesting tradition. Maybe some of our listeners aren't even aware about what I'm talking about.
Well, there is a superstition about Macbeth, and I should have been a little more prepared for this. I am the least superstitious person I know, so I don't pay a lot of attention to this. But there is a superstition, and I know many people who are very bound to that idea that Macbeth is an unlucky play. And I think that's based on the fact that in productions in the past, things have happened. Actors have been hurt, injured, things have fallen. It's sort of an idea that the play is cursed because of the power of Macbeth and his darkness, and therefore you don't say the word Macbeth, and you certainly don't say it in the theater. So people will call it the Scottish play or Mackers, but people often will not use the word Macbeth. I, on the other hand, sort of at the first rehearsal just came in and washed the theater in the word Macbeth over and over again. That's sort of my superstition to break the curse.
Right.
And we'll see what happens
when
the play opens, whether I brought down thunder or whether it's okay.
If the Rita burns down, we'll
know whose fault it is.
And I don't mean to make light on what was actually quite a tragedy, but back in the days when we were in the old building, so that's how long ago we're talking, I think it was the late 80s, maybe the early 90s, at the Metropolitan Opera, they were doing Giuseppe Verdi's Macbeth, and it was a broadcast. And during the first intermission, I believe, they were obviously filling for time. They went to announcer Peter Allen, who kind of tap danced a little bit, and they went back to the opera quiz for like additional questions, went back to Peter Allen, who kept talking some more. And at one point, he finally said, there's been an emergency here at the Met. And so that's why today's performance is delayed. And then he kept talking. I felt so badly for him. And it went on and on and on and on. You wondered what in the world is going on at the Met? Because, I mean, the place can't be on fire. Or it can't be. I mean, they obviously hoped to perhaps continue the performance. And then eventually he came on and said, I'm sorry to say that the remainder of today's performance is canceled, and signed off a few seconds later. And that was back before the internet. So you couldn't just Google
and find out what happened.
Right. So it wasn't until midway through the evening news that night that we finally learned that, unfortunately, an elderly patron who was seated in one of the upper balconies at the Met had jumped off the edge of the balcony and committed suicide. And that's what had happened there. That was the emergency that happened at the Met, and it was during a performance of Verdi's Macbeth. And
so you're suggesting to me that perhaps I should rethink my ideas about
Well, no,
about
not
the
necessarily.
Curse.
But I mean,
it's too late. If it is, I apologize to everyone.
No, but that was the first, I'm not particularly a theater person. And so that's actually the first I ever heard about, the so-called curse of Macbeth was that was made mention of when in certain articles that were written about this really sad moment at the Met.
Right.
And I just, it struck me as such a curious thing. And I still don't quite understand where that comes from or why it has such a powerful hold.
Right. And I wish I had more detail about that. But, I think it's interesting that theater is a sort of superstitious, or people in the theater can be fairly superstitious. And there are so many examples. I'm sure if you Google this, you can find of theaters that are haunted. I'm putting that in quotes. People talk about ghosts of characters past who never leave the theater. So there is a whole, a lot of lore, I guess, about that whole idea of both good ghosts and bad ghosts and sort of superstitious ideas. And I think in a world that is magical, where people use their imagination, it perhaps makes sense that that kind of idea lives on in the space or in the fact that people think about a play having a life beyond its performance.
Mm. We're speaking today with Lisa Kornetsky, professor of theater arts at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And we are talking today about Shakespeare's Macbeth. Yes, we're being forthright in saying its title.
We're going to do it. We'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. So, first of all, I think one of the very first times you and I spoke on the morning show, which is a long time ago, back in the late 1980s, probably 1988, I'm guessing, it was to talk about Romeo and Juliet. Do you remember directing that?
I do. Yes, I do.
So, and we've had the pleasure over the years of talking about other Shakespeare plays. Do you have any sense of how many Shakespeare plays you have directed at Parkside over the years?
I've only directed three at Parkside. I directed As You Like It, Romeo and Juliet, and now Macbeth. So, and Midsummer Night's Dream is a play that I directed as sort of my thesis production in graduate school. So I certainly have a love for Shakespeare, but I have not done a large number of the plays. Mm. And Macbeth is one that I just always felt someday I had to do because it's such an intriguing play. But it's been a long time since I've done a Shakespeare, certainly.
Mm. How often does it figure in the seasons at Parkside?
Up until last year, we were doing a Shakespeare every year, at least for the last maybe 12, 14 years.
That's what I was kind of thinking.
Last year, for a variety of reasons, we decided not to. And then this year, we're doing it again. We'll see about next year. I think some of our thinking is that Shakespeare is wonderful, but there are also a lot of other great classical plays out there. So we might some years replace Shakespeare with some other text-based non-prose piece. But Shakespeare is so much a part of the canon, and there is, I don't think there's anyone in our department, and probably not many theater people who wouldn't agree that Shakespeare really is our greatest writer, and his plays are so timeless that they're just important, and they're so rich that there's a tremendous amount to work with. Mm.
What kind of experience does it tend to be for your students? And I guess really what I'm interested in is it sort of a tough sell? Or is the typical theater student at Parkside eager and excited about doing Shakespeare?
I would say it could be a tough sell with our audiences, but not with our students. Our students really want to do Shakespeare. They know that they're going to get all kinds of sort of additional opportunities to particularly to deal with language and very complex characters. They also know that a lot of the work that's available to them, particularly in summer theater and internships, is in Shakespeare. So I think any of our students who are serious actors are really excited about the idea of having Shakespeare kind of under their belt, a couple of plays, and the ability to, or a basic understanding of how to approach the language and the text. So I think our students who are actors really love it. And our technicians and designers, I think, enjoy it as they do any play that allows us to do anything that's a concept play, that allows us to do some really exciting and different, maybe non-realistic or more theatrical kinds of special effects. So I think in the department, people are really happy to see us do Shakespeare. I think in the community and perhaps in the university with other students, Shakespeare still can be a hard sell because it's hard. You know, it's if people aren't used to the language, it sort of takes a while to get into it, to understand what's happening. But I think the more people are exposed to it, the more they enjoy it. At least I hope that that's the case.
Right. Right. I'm trying to remember over the course of these last dozen years or so, as Shakespeare has shown up regularly on your seasons, if it tends to be done relatively straight, or if there have been a fair number of instances where it's been, you know, set in the Old West or set on the moon or whatever is sometimes done with plays that are quite familiar to theatrical folk.
Well, I think, you know, just the whole idea of, and I know what you mean, but of doing Shakespeare straight is kind of, I mean, what does that even mean? Because we, you know, from what we know about the way Shakespeare's plays were performed, they were done, you know, fairly bare bones on a bare stage with costumes that would be more what the people of the, you know, in the Elizabethan period would wear. I think when we think of a straight, you know, I can't do quotes on the radio, but a straight Shakespearean production, we're probably thinking of something that looks very Elizabethan. And we rarely do that. So this play is set in, I mean, historically, it's the 11th century in Scotland. But like a lot of Shakespeare's plays, the location is somewhat, you know, it's certainly there and it's indicated, but it's not, you know, this isn't a history play where, you know, complete historical accuracy becomes really important. So I think for us doing Shakespeare, you know, the first question that you ask is, how does this play speak to us today? And what is the world that Shakespeare's talking about, and how does that fit into the world that we want to represent? So we tend to have the great opportunity to do what we call concept pieces or high concept pieces, where we really can think about a unique way of presenting the play. And that's one of the joys of Shakespeare. You know, you can't really do that with a play like Death of a Salesman or right. Streetcar Named Desire.
It's hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine because they're really set within a certain context. Shakespeare's plays, of course, are set within a context, but it's fairly loose, and I think you can actually make the play more powerful by not doing a straight production and trying to find theatrical ways to echo the theme and speak to a modern audience. So we're doing that, and I think you do. I don't know if you remember, many years ago we did a Hamlet with four Hamlets.
Oh yeah.
We did a Suzuki, which is sort of a Japanese acting method, Henry V. So I think it's a great opportunity to try new things in a way that a lot of other plays don't lend themselves to.
Right. One of the things we should talk about ahead of sort of explaining the plot of Macbeth itself is to talk about the fact that there was a real Macbeth in history. And maybe you could just say a brief word about the relationship between some of these persons in history and the characters that we meet in this play.
Right. So as with many of Shakespeare's plays, he finds the stories in multiple places. So there was a real Macbeth. There was a real Macduff. There was a real Malcolm, King Duncan. And the play is loosely based on some history of the time that was known to people. I think more important historically is the fact that the play, which was, I'll see if I have my dates right on the top of my head, but the play was written, I believe, in 1606, shortly after King James I became king. And King James I, shortly after he became king, made Shakespeare's company the king's company. And if you remember anything about your English history, James I was Scottish, and he was the king of Scotland first. He was, I believe, one of the sons of Mary, Queen of Scots. And son or grandson, I may be wrong there. And then several years later, he became also the king of England, and he sort of united those two countries. So he came to the throne. He was a great supporter of Shakespeare and Shakespeare's theater. And he is a descendant, it was thought, of Banquo, who is one of the central characters in Macbeth, and a character who we find early on is going to be the that his sons and generations of his family will become kings. Mm. So there is sort of homage to King James in the play in terms of what it means to be a good king or a bad king. And the end of Macbeth reunites Scotland, the good king prevails. And so there is sort of the historical piece there that I think is really interesting. Shakespeare, like a lot of playwrights of his time, took freely from history and kind of changed things as he would in terms of locations and, you know, who exactly did what. But we do know that there was a Macbeth, that he was killed by Macduff, but whether he was the king as he is described in this play, probably not.
Hmm. There are witches in Macbeth.
Oh, yes.
And my understanding is that one of the reasons there are witches is because there, from time to time, there was sort of an interest in, and if you will, a belief in witches in this particular period. I hadn't remembered that, or I think of that as an isolated, a weird American chapter in our own history with the Salem witch trials, roughly sort of the same time. This apparently was happening to some extent in England, too.
What we experienced in the United States or America was nothing like what happened in Europe from, I believe it's from the 14th through the 16th, 1700s. Huge witch purges throughout the continent. In England, there were laws about who you could persecute and how and in what way. But there was certainly a strong belief in this period in witchcraft by many people, just as there was in fairies and sprites. You know, when you do Midsummer Night's Dream and you sort of look into that, there was a whole different idea of the supernatural in that time. And witches were really believed by some people to be usually women, To have a familiar, so some kind of animal that sort of linked them to the devil, to use sexual powers to drain men of their power, and to be, generally speaking, a great threat to civilization. And back to King James, King James was very interested and a strong believer in witches, and he actually wrote a book called Demonology. So again, Shakespeare, we think, may have really been paying homage to the king and his interests by having the witches play this presence. In the play, they're referred to as the Weird Sisters, and the word weird is an old English word that refers to fate and destiny. So they become a very important presence in the play in terms of their impact on Macbeth.
Interesting. Well, first of all, I feel stupid that I didn't know any of that, that I've had such a narrow understanding of that whole phenomenon of witches. I remember now this matter of them being the strange sisters, did you say?
Weird sisters.
The Weird Sisters, because in the current production of the opera, the Verdi opera at the Met, the witches, I mean, there are a lot of strange things in this production, but the witches are actually sort of strange, batty old little old ladies carrying purses. Mm. And I remember the designer or director making reference to what they're sort of thought of in the play. And that was the inspiration for that sort of intriguing design.
If you watch some of the film versions that are available to people, it's very interesting to see how the witches were portrayed. They're often, I mean, they're described in the play as hags with beards and, you know, seemingly women, but not quite sure if they are. But there's some films that have them as sort of old women, that have them as children, nurses. There are multiple ways that the witches can be portrayed, and I think that's an exciting opportunity for a production team to decide, who are these witches? Are they real? What do they represent? And certainly in our production, that's a keystone to our concept.
Mm. Those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Lisa Kornetsky, professor of theater arts at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We are talking today about Shakespeare's Macbeth, which is opening this coming weekend, running for two weekends at Parkside. So, Lisa, why don't you, we've kind of touched on the historical Macbeth, but now why don't you say whatever you feel like you want to say about how the plot of Shakespeare's play unfolds?
So I think most people, when you say Macbeth, most people have some basic idea of the plot of Macbeth. And it's a pretty straightforward play. It begins with a battle, and the forces of Norway have conspired with some of King Duncan's men to attack the country, and King Duncan's forces, through Macbeth and his good friend Banquo, have won the battle. As they leave the battle, Macbeth and Banquo come upon the three witches, these weird sisters we were just talking about, who deliver him a message which says that he will be king. First, he will be the Thane of Cawdor, and then he will be king, but Banquo's sons will continue the line of succession. And then they disappear. Hmm. And moments later, other men from the court come and say, congratulations, you've been made the Thane of Cawdor. So immediately after being told this information, Macbeth finds that the first part of it is true. And this plants this idea in him that he is meant to be king, and the way to be king is to kill a king. So
can't kill the current king.
Kill the current king, right. So Macbeth sends a letter to his wife. He arrives home. They conspire together. They kill the king. And then the story quickly moves forward. This is one of the fastest moving Shakespearean plays, I find. But one event propels Macbeth onto the next event. So the more he does, the more he commits crimes for his ambition, the more sort of bloodthirsty he becomes, and it sort of continues to propel until the breaking point. And in the play, his wife, who has been at first very right there with him about committing this deed, becomes more and more unhinged by what they have done, and eventually she loses her mind. Macbeth, on the other hand, keeps moving forward and sort of cannot stop. Once he's set on this path, he cannot stop himself. and he loses many of his supporters. The king's son is in England. He gets a huge 10,000 men to come to Scotland, and they battle with Macbeth, and Macbeth is slain. So that is the pretty simple plot, but it really focuses on this idea of unchecked ambition. And I think the main question one always asks oneself in this play is, what is it that drives Macbeth? What is it that propels him to take this first step? And how is it that he cannot stop himself from continuing to move forward?
Right. It's interesting. I never stopped to think about it until you spelled it out as you did. It really is a relatively simple plot.
Very simple plot.
Especially compared to certain other Shakespeare plays, although I suppose in many cases some of his plays are simpler than they might appear at a glance in
right.
terms of what they're really about. Their heart is in a sense kind of a simple thing.
Well, and there's really no subplot in this play the way there is in so many of Shakespeare's plays. So it is a simple plot, and it moves pretty quickly. It has a number of battle scenes. It has a lot of action. It has many short scenes that propel into the next scene. So it is, in that way, it is a fairly simply crafted play in terms of the plot. In terms of themes, I think it's quite complex, or at least there are multiple ways of viewing the play.
Right. So we have these two central figures who are so fascinating in so many ways, Macbeth and his wife, Lady Macbeth. Mm-hmm. Describe each of them, especially as they are on the page, in a sense. I mean, as Shakespeare has crafted them.
Well, the interesting thing about Macbeth and Lady Macbeth is that we know very little about them from before the play begin. So we're not given a lot of exposition. We're not given a lot of textual hints about who they are, other than, he's the Thane of Glamis. He's a great warrior. There's some indication that they had a child who is no longer living. There are a number of times, or a couple of times, where Lady Macbeth refers to breastfeeding, and it could be metaphorical, but I think the decision that we made is that they have lost a child. And I think that is helpful to sort of building the character for those actors.
Interesting.
But what's interesting to me about the fact that we have so little information about them is that when we see them very early on, they are both determined to make this prophecy of the witches come true. So we know that they're incredibly ambitious, and that this is something, when once this idea is planted, they cannot let it go. The other thing that we know is that they have, it's probably the best relationship in Shakespeare, despite who these characters are. There's a great love between them and passion between them. And we get to see how that changes through the course of fulfilling this prophecy or going forward, and how that tends to break them apart in some ways. But as characters, I think they're quite complex. At least we hope that they are, in the sense that it's too easy to make Macbeth and Lady Macbeth evil, and to just suggest that that they're committing these crimes because they're ambitious. So I think we've worked really hard to make Macbeth, or to understand Macbeth's drive, and to see how, even though he doesn't go mad in the same way that Lady Macbeth does, but to see how it creates almost this manic fervor in him, and he cannot stop. It's interesting, if you think about Hamlet and Macbeth as these two really iconic Shakespearean characters in these tragedies. Hamlet is the character who, can't move forward, isn't sure how to take action. He's kind of stopped by trying to decide what to do. And Macbeth kind of doesn't even think about it. He just moves forward, and then he can't stop. So it's kind of an interesting way to think of how Shakespeare's, over his time of writing these great characters. King Lear is someone who kind of lives in the past and can't live comfortably in the present, and Macbeth is way ahead of everybody else in the future, a future that can't exist. So it's kind of interesting to think about the psychology of Macbeth. And Lady Macbeth,
you know, I see her as someone who really wants everything for her husband and for herself. Hmm. But once she takes this action, she cannot live with what's happened. She says many times, what's done is done. We cannot undo what's done. Hmm. But there is this hesitation in her that grows as we see her, and this discomfort with where she is, so that when we have the great out damn spot scene where we see her sleepwalking and in great distress, her mind is broken, you know, we kind of understand how this deed has been more than she can handle. And the same is true for Macbeth. They just go in opposite directions.
Wow.
If that makes sense.
That's fascinating, because the way it comes off in the Verdi opera, again, which is what I know so much better than the play, you really sort of, I mean, in some ways they are kindred spirits, but in many ways in the opera, Lady Macbeth is the driving force.
Right.
And maybe that's one reason why she feels so much more guilt so much sooner, and is the one who kind of goes crazy first. But there's this sense that he is a little more inert, or a little more, in a sense, a tepid force. And if it were not for Lady Macbeth driving him forward, probably none of this would unfold as it does.
I definitely think you can. I mean, the question is. Is it within Macbeth? Is it Lady Macbeth? Or is it the witches? You know, what is it that prompts him forward? And there are two things that I would say about that. The first thing I would say, and I've thought about this a lot as we've moved through the rehearsal process, is that sort of my interpretation of this play probably has a lot to do with my own philosophy of human nature. And I don't believe that people are inherently evil, nor do I believe that people are inherently good. I believe that human nature is complex, and we live in within a context. And so who we are, whilst our personality and, you know, our inner traits may be fixed, but who we are and how we handle the choices that we make has a lot to do with nurture and the environment that we live in. So I kind of think this idea of human nature and the capacity for both great goodness and doing great harm is within all of us. So that there are multiple things that work on Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. But for me, the more interesting choice, and this is the way we've moved conceptually, is that it's within all of us, you know, that this here is this opportunity, and some of us would not take it and some of us might take it, but that it is the witches and the queen of the witches, Hecate, who have provided this fertile ground and have been suggesting and moving and creating this framework for Macbeth, and all he needs to do is sort of push the button and do it. Lady Macbeth, you know, he is at first more inert, and she is more vocal. She challenges his masculinity. She pushes him. But ultimately, you know, he bears responsibility for what he does. And then she joins him in some, you know, she finishes the task by smearing the grooms with blood so that they will be thought to have committed the crime. But I think you could go multiple ways. I just love the idea of this kind of supernatural, or we're thinking of it almost as a natural force, which kind of represents the power and destruction of nature, kind of being mirrored with human nature and creating this opportunity, or this, again, fertile ground for the humans in the world to take action. And
right.
I find that to be, you know, when I look at the world today, I find that to be, it really speaks to me, you know, that people live in circumstances where they do things that, I mean, I don't believe anyone is born to be, you know, a suicide bomber or any of the other horrible things, but people live within a context, and the world is moving, and things happen, and the environment suggests things, and people move forward and maybe never look back. And I think human nature allows us to be that suggestible.
Right. Right. Well, and I think you're also touching on the fact that a lot of this ends up being about choices.
Absolutely.
Choices that people make, and it's not about the inevitable sweep of destiny. And I started realizing I'm so sick of that. I'm so sick, that is, of epic stories that are all about, in a sense, destiny and predestination and you know, fulfilling something that was destined to happen from before you were born. And after a while, I just find that to be, in a sense, kind of the opposite of what a great drama should be, because it's like there's no drama in that. It's just a matter of, you know, what's going to blow up or who you're going to kill or whatever. But it's like all of this has to happen. And it's so much more interesting when it's
about choices.
Right. And yeah, free will and these situations that arise and what somebody chooses to do. Does Macbeth choose to kill King Duncan or not?
And what's in him, you know, what are the complex factors that contribute to his making that choice?
Right, versus just inevitability of this is my legacy, this is my calling, this
I always think the best stories, whether they be novels or plays, but really are, you know, that point where the central character comes to a crossroads and they have to make a choice.
Yes.
And it's in that moment of the choice that I think the story either comes alive or it doesn't. So in this play, you kind of can't avoid the idea of the weird sisters. And it'll be interesting to see how we've really pushed that pretty far in terms of some of the choices that we've made. But again, our feeling is not that they actually force Macbeth to do anything. They just bring out what's already in him. And you know, create this opportunity for him to see his opportunity in a way that allows him to move forward. Because there's nothing in the play before he meets those witches that indicates his ambition. We know that he was a great warrior. He's won this battle, and clearly that's been part of who he is. But it's not as if we get any backstory about, you know, Macbeth plotting and scheming earlier in the play. So there is sort of this sense of what is it that prompts us or provokes us in a moment to make a choice that, you know, to do something heinous, you know, is it in our nature? Is it in the circumstance? And I find that a fascinating thing to think about.
I do, too. I'm reminded of one of my all-time favorite interviews, which was a woman wrote a book about her own father's suicide. And I remember at one point in this book, it's called The Suicide Index. And at one point she says, I wish I could quote it because I remember she writes it so beautifully. She essentially says, I will never know if this choice my father made to shoot himself and end his life, if it was just a horrible sort of insane decision made just in a twisted moment, or if it was years and years and years in her, I think her words were, of the sand seeping out of the bag until finally that's where he was. And because he left no note, there is no way she will ever know the answer to that question. But I thought that was so interesting. It really speaks to what you're talking about.
Right.
Sometimes
the
choices we make are berserk choices made in the moment, and sometimes they are the result of months and maybe years of who knows what that sort of lead us slowly to that.
Yeah, and I think the thing that is intriguing about Macbeth, for those people who don't know the play, one of the things that the witches say to Macbeth is that they talk about Birnam Wood coming to Dunsinane, that he will remain king until Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane. So, you know, well, the woods can never come to my castle, so I'm fine.
Right, the trees aren't going to become
aren't
alive.
Come, but then, of course, the soldiers cut the boughs of the trees and to hide them as they march towards Dunsinane. And so Birnam Wood, in fact, metaphorically does come to Dunsinane. And there's just sort of this sense of, you know, who's in control? What you know, what are the controlling factors? And I think it's really fascinating to think about how Macbeth as a character in the world that he lives in knows that he's losing control, knows that things are spiraling, but he says, you know, I cannot stop. It's better to go on in this bloody deed than to stop and try to undo. And even at the end, when the last thing that the witches have said to him is that he will never be killed by anyone of woman born. And in his last battle with Macduff, where he still believes that he cannot be killed, as they're fighting, they're yelling at each other, and Macduff answers that by saying, you know, I was untimely ripped from my mother's womb, so he was not born through a traditional delivery, and therefore he can kill Macbeth. So it's just, you know, all of these factors coming together so that Macbeth, who thought he could control what happened, can't. Everything just spirals.
Yeah, it's bigger than him.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, let's talk for a moment about what it's been like for your students to confront this great play, and particularly the challenges of doing Shakespeare well, and in particular, rendering the language of Shakespeare well. I suppose some of your actors have some experience in that, and probably for others, this is a new adventure.
Some do, and some don't. Some have been in shows before, Shakespearean shows. Some have taken classes where they've done that. We have a wonderful new member of our faculty who had been a visiting faculty member with us, but is now a tenure-track faculty member, Brian Gill, who's the head of our acting program.
I've interviewed him a couple times.
Yes, and Brian is wonderful, and he's not only is he the fight choreographer for the show, and he's wonderful at that, but he has really come in and helped quite a bit with individual actors working on speech, teaching people the kind of first folio method, which he works with a lot. For me, the most important thing, I mean, it's a complex, for a director, it's a very complex play. We have 16 actors playing 42 roles. You know, there's a lot to think about in this play. So for me, what's most important is that the language supports what the actors are doing and saying, and that the actors are living within the language and making sense of it. And that's not always easy. It's very easy to understand the overall sense of what a line is or what a speech is, but Shakespeare's words are so beautiful, and within any line there are many things that are happening. So I'm really interested in them understanding the imagery, finding the operative words, finding ways to make language that is not easy to understand understandable to an audience. And that's that's complex when you
add
everything else that you're doing.
Absolutely. Visually, what is your production going to look like?
So one of the first things that we wanted to talk about was, what is this world? And we decided that a 11th century Scottish world, historically accurate in some way, was not nearly as interesting as sort of playing with the juxtaposition of the natural world, which is wild and violent and untamed, and a very formal world of civilization. So we're sort of looking at those two things. So because in our production, the witches are very prominent, we have trees on stage. So our witches spend a lot of time listening, making noise, hovering in those trees. We're doing this show in our Black Box Theater, which is the first time that I can remember doing a Shakespeare in that space. And it's wonderfully intimate for this play. Of course, our real reason for doing it is that we are getting a new rigging system in our main stage, so that that space was unavailable. But what the studio is allowing us to do is to have the actors above, behind, around, underneath the audience. So we're really – this is a very violent play, and it's a pretty scary play. So we're finding those really dark places. So it's smoky. It's dim. It's very expressionistic. The actors who are in the civilized world are in modern but very angular, cold clothing. The makeup and hair are very – extreme, I would say. And the witches are this wonderful combination of many different cultural influences. So we have some Asian influence in what people are wearing and look like. We have some African, some kinds of I hesitate to use this word, but I will, but kind of tribal influences. And there's a lot of really interesting movement that the witches do. So it's a visually, I think it's a very exciting world. We have projections. We have screens that move. We have a turntable.
Holy cow.
That creates new locations.
Wow.
We have some magic that happens. We have a lot. There's a lot of stage combat. So it's, I think visually, it's a pretty dynamic world. And there's a ton of movement in that small space with people exiting upstage right and quietly running around and entering a moment later from upstage left, you know. So we're having a lot of fun with the staging of
it. Wow. This also reminds me of something from that very first conversation about Romeo and Juliet 1,000 years ago where I remember you lamenting the fact that you had staged somebody's murder. I forget how many murders happen in Romeo and Juliet, but when What's-His-Face gets killed by Romeo, and you stage that way down stage towards the audience.
Right.
And then you kind of lamented the fact you wished you'd staged it further upstage because, you know, in a sense, the audience is right there to see whether or not that murder looks authentic or not. In a sense, a lot of what you've created will be right under the noses, practically in the laps of your audience members.
Right, it's a three-quarter, so the audience is sitting on three sides. Well, first of all, I think our students are doing a great job with the wonderful choreography that Brian has given us. But one of the issues also is you have to get these dead bodies off of the stage. You know, you can't. We don't have enough people to come out and, you know, carry. But I think for us, you know, I don't ever want the audience to actually believe that the fight is real, particularly when they're, you know, so you want to find this, you want people to be in the fight and believing in the possibility of it, but you don't want the audience to ever worry for the actors.
Right.
And when they're right there, that, you know, that's a complicated thing. I think there's enough theatricality that it works, but certainly depending on where you're sitting, you're going to see a punch that hits a hand. But I think we're doing a really good job with that. And the way people are actually – we're using knives, not swords. And the way people are actually killed, I think, is very authentic. And one of the things – and I can hear Brian saying it – that it's not as much the actual movements in the fight. I mean, that's very important, of course. But it's the way the actor sells the fight.
Mm.
So it's how you die. It's the noises that you make. It's, you know, so if someone gets punched – in the face, you know, we talk about, so was your nose broken? Was your cheek fractured? What's the sound that comes? I mean, how do you respond to that? So I think it's the selling of it that makes it work for the audience.
Sounds exciting. This is Shakespeare's Macbeth opening this weekend, and it runs the following weekend as well. Exactly when are the performances, and what do people do for ticket information?
Okay, so first let me tell you, for ticket information, you can call our box office at 262-595-2564, or you can go online to one word, uwparksidetickets.com, and order your tickets online. The play opens this Friday, October 21st, and runs the 21st, 22nd, 27th, 28th, and 29th at 7:30. And then October 23rd, this coming Sunday, we've added a 2 p.m. matinee because we're doing very well with ticket sales. One of the nice things is that the Kenosha Public Schools read Macbeth as part of their curriculum. So we have three student matinees. We actually open this Friday morning at 10 a.m. with a student matinee, and we have a student matinee the following Friday. So most of those seats are sold out, but there's the possibility for that. But the Sunday matinee, for those people who don't want Macbeth late at night, can come on the Sunday.
Very good. Lisa Konetsky, Professor of Theatrical Arts, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been yet another fun conversation about a great, great play.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we want to make sure you understand this. We've had to shuffle our schedule this week. What was going to air Friday is going to air tomorrow, a conversation with the author of a wonderful book called Dog Medicine, How My Dog Saved Me From Myself, a really interesting, moving, true story about a woman who was in a